Jacob got a tree planted for him at the front of the school, a plaque under it that I pass every day walking in that reads, "We'll miss you, Jay." Sammy got a moment of silence during first period that year, and an entire page of the yearbook devoted to her memory. They read Haley's name at graduation. But Ty got his locker packed up and delivered promptly back to my mother before we'd even had a chance to bury him. Because it was suicide. Because they don't want to seem like they're condoning it. Ashley sees Grayson's expression and turns to see what he's looking at. She sees me standing there, frozen. All at once, a myriad of emotions pass over her face. Confusion, pity, embarrassment over kissing Grayson, and, oh yes, there it is, an emotion I'm most familiar with these days, rising in her deep blue eyes. Guilt. I know guilt when I see it. I do a quick 180. I leave my tray on the table and walk stiffly past Sadie and her questioning expression, past my other friends who are looking at me too, out of the cafeteria. I go to my locker, set the letter in its place in the 5-subject notebook on the top shelf, and slam the door. I'm angry, it turns out. The image of my mother's face swims up in my mind when she took the box from Grayson after he rang our doorbell, the way she tried to smile at him, to thank him, before she brought it back to the kitchen table and opened it and started crying all over again, lifting out Ty's gym shoes and his extra deodorant and the tiny magnetic mirror that he used to smile into every day. A-holes. All of them. A-holes. And Ashley was kissing Grayson, my brother's a-hole friend. The guy, if the slightly crooked nose is any indication, who Ty punched that day when he got suspended from school. Over Ashley. Ty punched him over Ashley. I have to consider the possibility that Ashley Davenport, that lovely girl inside and out, the right kind of girl, the nicest, might be the biggest a-hole of them all. Is there still a shredder in Dad's office? I ask Mom when I get home. She frowns.
Yes, why?
I got a credit card application in the mail, I explain smoothly. I would have just thrown it out, but then I remembered that you and Dad always shred that kind of thing. It's getting marginally easier to lie to my mother.
Oh, Mom says. Yes, that sounds like a good idea.
Still in the cold anger I haven't been able to shake from school, I head down the hall to Dad's old office. The door to this room is usually shut, as if Mom can't stand the sight of his absence. When he lived with us, he kept the door open so he could catch us as we walked by.
"Hey there, Peanut,"
he'd always say when he spotted me, and I would stand in the doorway for a few minutes, shooting the breeze with the old man, as he called it, telling him about my day at school or whatever book I was reading or the square root of some number I'd memorized. I don't stop to look around as I enter the office. I go straight to the shredder. I turn it on. I take the letter out of my bag. I want to destroy it. I want this whole mess to be over with. Ty's unfinished business, his presence, real or not, lingering in this house. His problem. His, not mine. I want to go to college and leave this part of my life behind. Start over. Be someone else besides the girl whose brother died. I've earned that, I think. I don't want to think about Ty anymore. I finger an edge of the envelope that's curling up, the glue there coming unstuck. I've been handling it too much and the paper is showing some wear. It would be so easy to open it and find out everything. I want to get his explanation. In his own words, I want him to tell me why. I catch a whiff of my brother's cologne.
What? You want me to give it to her?
I say. There's no answer. Then I ask him the question that's been on my mind all this time, even though he's probably not even here.
Why her? Why Ashley? Why would you write her a letter and not write one to me? Didn't you have anything worthwhile to say to me?
No answer. But the silence feels like an answer. I swallow. I think about the text. I refuse to feel guilty about something you did, I mumble. But I don't mean it. I do feel guilty. Every single day. I turn the shredder off.
I got into MIT,
I whisper to the empty room. He would have been proud of me if he were alive. He would have known how much it meant. 19. Friday. I'm already on edge when I get to school. I haven't burned the letter or shredded it or thrown it away yet. All things I've been tempted to do so I don't have to get involved in this Ashley Ty Grayson affair. I have it with me, still stuck in the pages of my notebook. I can't leave it home on the off chance that someone else, insert mom, will find it. I can't let anybody else find it. In that way, it belongs to me. I'm hungry. I walk to the vending machine in the corner and fish out a crinkled dollar. I missed breakfast, i.e. mom didn't get up to make it and I didn't have the energy to pour myself a bowl of cereal. I put the dollar in. The machine spits it out. I put it in. It spits it out. It's worse than the lemon. Come on, I plead. I require sustenance. Not that there's anything good in the machine to eat. Dried fruit, granola bars, whole grain pretzels, organic, gluten-free seaweed chips. This is Nebraska, for crying out loud. Land of meat, potatoes, corn, and corn as the five basic food groups. I'm suddenly struck by a memory of Ty standing in this exact spot, banging on this exact machine until a bag of dried apricots dropped into the slot. He picked it up, scowled.
I don't care what the First Lady says, he complained, loudly enough that the people around us started nodding in agreement. This is not a Pop-Tart. I need my junk food, man. How's a growing boy to survive on all this healthy stuff? Am I right?
He's right. My throat closes. I miss him, I miss him, I miss him. The hole in my chest explodes. I can't breathe, I can't breathe. There are people waiting for the machine behind me, so I don't have time to let the hole pass on its own. I stumble to the side and force my legs to move away, down the hall to the restroom, where I almost run to the last stall and sit down on the lid of the toilet and bend my head over my knees and gasp and gasp and think maybe this drug thing Dave suggested isn't a bad idea after all. I'm not doing well here, clearly. When the hole fills in again, my body feels achy, like I'm coming down with something. I flush the toilet as if I was in there for a good reason. I go out, take my glasses off, and splash some water on my face. The girls on either side of me don't say anything. They just return to meticulously washing their hands. I lean forward to take a long look at myself in the mirror. There are dark circles under my eyes, and my lips are chapped and colorless. I swipe at a wet tendril of hair that's clinging to my forehead, but then it just sticks to a different spot. The whites of my eyes look like road maps, veiny and red-rimmed and swollen, like I've been crying, even though I haven't been crying. I look wrecked. This whole thing has warped me, I think. I'm a board left out in the rain, and it's impossible to go back to being straight and undamaged ever again. This is who I am now, the girl whose brother died. Plus, there's the fun fact that I am losing my mind. I'm here at school freaking out about a stupid letter that my dead brother wrote for his ex. Why exactly? Because some part of me thinks that Ty's still around. Because I think maybe that drawer being open that night and that letter being in that drawer means that he wants me to deliver it. Because no matter how much I try to be rational, some part of me wants to believe that I am seeing his freaking ghost. This, for some reason, makes me laugh. The sound is sharp and bounces off the tight white-tiled walls of the bathroom. Hilarious! One of the girls next to me gets the heck out of there. She just bolts for the door. But the other girl waits for me to pull myself together. She hands me a paper towel to dry my face, and when I put my glasses back on, I realize it's Ashley Davenport. Awesome. Hi, she says. I saw you come in here, and I wanted to talk to you, so... So she witnessed my little breakdown. Even more awesome. She's wearing a bright pink cardigan over a white sequined tank top, silvery lip gloss gleaming off her cupid's bow lips, and a gold heart-shaped necklace that's resting in the hollow of her throat. She's beautiful.
What sticks out to me the most about her is that she looks healthy, is the word that comes to mind. Not just in her athletic legs and shiny red hair and bright eyes and dewy porcelain skin. It's more than that. She has all the signs of a person who life has left almost completely undamaged. I bet her parents are still together and still hold hands and still kiss. I bet she volunteers for some kind of charity. I bet the most tears she's ever shed in her whole life were over her childhood dog when it died of old age. She's not an a-hole, I think. She's a nice girl. But that doesn't change how I feel. There's nothing I want to talk about, I say. Not with you. She puts her hand on my arm, gently but insistently.
Wait, I know you saw me and Grayson in the cafeteria yesterday. You looked upset, so I thought you might have thought...
I might have thought what? I challenge. That you cheated on my brother? Her eyes widen.
But I didn't cheat on Ty. I would never. He broke up with me, not the other way around. I would never have cheated on Ty.
But what about the fight? When Ty punched Grayson, why would he do that? She bows her head.
I was sad after Ty broke it off. He didn't even tell me why. He just came up to me that morning and said things weren't working out between us. He said he was sorry, and then he walked off. I was shocked. I thought we were... I cried. I was upset. People thought he was being a jerk, and the next day Grayson said something rude to Ty about it, and...
Ty hit him. I fill in. She squeezes my arm.
I wasn't into Grayson back then. We just started dating like a week ago, I swear.
I don't know what to say. Her lip starts trembling. A tear shines on the edge of her eye. I wish I could cry so easily.
Your brother was an amazing guy, she continues. Everybody liked him. They were only mad at him because of me, but they would have gotten over it. I don't know why he would...
She pauses. Of course she does. But then she looks at me like I'm going to tell her now why Ty did it. Why someone like my brother, who everybody liked, who was cute and funny and popular, thought his existence was so terrible that he chose to end it. Because I'm his sister. I should know the reasons why.
I should have realized that he was... I didn't know.
She lets go of my arm and presses her lips together, like she's about to start really crying.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, Lex.
I have to go. I back away from Ashley, then push out of the bathroom and into the noisy, crowded hall. I walk on autopilot back to my locker. I lean against it, watching everybody pass by, ready to head toward class, ready to start their days. I lean my head back until it touches the cool metal of the locker, and close my eyes. She didn't dump him. She didn't cheat on him. It's not her fault. She doesn't even know why he broke up with her, which makes Ty the a-hole in this scenario. My eyes snap open. I unzip my backpack, pull out my 5-subject notebook, and retrieve the letter. I don't give myself any time to think about what I'm doing. I don't make a plan. I just head down to room 121B. I wait outside the door for the students to trickle in.
"Hey, Lex," Damien says, slinking up to me.
He gives his head a little shake to get his hair out of his eyes, smiles, fidgets.
"Fancy meeting you here."
"Yeah."
"Did you finish Heart of Darkness?"
I nod distractedly.
"Oh, the horror."
He laughs.
"The horror. So what are you doing here? Not that I'm complaining, but aren't you a little old for this class?"
"An errand," I say. "I'm running an errand." "Hey, it's good to see you, Damien, but you should probably..." I gesture toward the classroom. "I don't want to be responsible for you getting marked tardy."
"It's good to see you, too," he says,
smiling his painful-looking smile again, and then he goes to take his seat. Ashley shows up just as the bell rings. This time she doesn't bowl me over when she appears from around the corner. She slows down when she sees me, suddenly unsure of herself. Then she stops.
"Hi,"
she says. "Hi," I say back. Sorry about before. Sometimes I get overwhelmed by everything. She bites her lip. For some reason, she looks frightened. Maybe she can sense what's coming. I was wrong earlier, I say quickly, and before I can lose my nerve, I pull the letter from the inside pocket of my coat and hold it out. It trembles between us. This is for you, from Ty. If it's possible for her face to get any whiter, it does. Even her lips drain of color. She doesn't reach for the letter. Take it, I say, thrusting it at her. He wanted you to have it. She takes it. I feel lighter the second the envelope leaves my hand. Ashley stares down at it, her eyes tracing Ty's sloppy letters spelling her name. I didn't read it, I feel compelled to tell her. I don't know what it says, but it's for you. I can't think of what else to say, and we're both late to class, so I whisper, I'm sorry. Although I don't know what I'm apologizing for Ty or for me, and then I walk away. I hope it's the right thing. It feels like the right thing. Probably. Maybe. But at least it's all over with now. It's done. 9th of March. My parents used to tell this story over and over, year after year, about the first time I ever saw Ty. According to family legend, I was playing at the park by my house when it happened. I was on the swings being pushed by my grandmother, who'd been looking after me while my mother was at the hospital. When my parents came into view, walking slowly across the grass toward us, Grandma lifted me out of the bucket swing, set me on the ground, gave me a little push, and said, "Go, meet your brother." I ran to my parents. They'd prepped me about this, of course, with months of talking about a new baby brother and what a good big sister I'd be, feeling Mom's distended belly, singing to it, reading books about how we have to be quiet when the baby's sleeping, and we have to sit down to hold the baby and never poke the baby in the eye. They'd shown me the new baby's freshly painted room and moved me into a big girl bed so he could have my crib. They'd even bought me a t-shirt that had the words Big Sister in silvery, sparkly letters across the chest. I was wearing it that day. Or so they tell me. It was a lot of hype. Too much hype, probably. When I reached them, my dad knelt and showed me the blue-wrapped bundle in his arms. A tiny, disgruntled person with a round, purplish face, eyelids that were so swollen it was hard to tell what color the eyes were, and a head that bore only a small, thin tuft of brown hair. He wasn't the best-looking baby, my brother. I looked at him. He looked at me. Then he went cross-eyed. "He's not cute," is what I famously said, clearly disappointed. I thought he was going to be cute. Apparently, I've always had a problem with calling it like I see it. But then I laid my hand on the top of the baby's nearly hairless head. "Hello, brother," I said, by way of introduction. "Tyler," Mom provided. "His name is Tyler." "Ty," I confirmed. "Can I hold him?" I sat down cross-legged right there in the grass, and Dad laid Ty carefully in my lap. I looked up at Mom and smiled. "He's mine," I announced. "My baby. Mine." Yep, that's how the story goes. 2 minutes into meeting my baby brother, I claimed him as my own personal property. He may not have been cute, but he was my brother. Mine. I realize that almost everybody has a story like this. It's not unique. I read somewhere that approximately 80% of Americans have at least one brother or sister. There's a predictable formula to these stories. Older sibling meets younger. Older sibling says something cute, or rude or funny, but always cute, and everyone laughs, and the older sibling eventually gets used to the idea that he/she isn't the center of the world anymore. There's a reason we tell these stories again and again. Because they define us. The first time I was a sister. The first time we were all together as a family. Now I try to remember that day as more than a story I've heard. I try to call up the wind on my face as I ran across the field, my heart thumping, my dad smiling as he crouched down, the smooth heat of Ty's head under my fingers, the smell of baby powder and garden roses, the grass prickly against my knees.
but I don't know if any of that is real or just a bunch of happy details I imagined to fill in the blanks of my parents' fairy tale, which they've told so many times it started to feel like memory. I was 2 years old when Ty was born. But I do remember this. He cried. I think he cried every night, really, but I remember this one particular night. I woke to the sound of him crying, a thin wail that filled the house. I got out of bed and padded in stocking feet into his room, then boosted myself over the railings of the crib and lay down beside him. He stopped crying to look at me. I pulled his blanket back over him. He'd kicked it off. He was cold. "Don't worry," I said. "I'll take care of you." We stayed that way for I don't know how long, looking at each other. Then Dad was there, smiling down at both of us, his hand cupping the back of my head, and he said,
"Well, look at you two, all quiet and cozy. You calmed him right down. Well done, Peanut. Well done."
And I remember being proud. I had made things right when they were wrong. 20. On Monday, Sadie shows up at my back door before school, just like when we were 8 years old, when she'd stand on the steps and tap on the glass sliding door, like, "Can Lexi come out to play?" until Mom heard her and let her in. "Lex," Mom calls down the hall, "you have a visitor." I come running. "Think fast." Sadie throws me a Pop-Tart, cherry, my favorite. She still remembers my favorite.
"Breakfast is served," she says.
I glance over at Mom to see if she's offended by the notion that Sadie apparently believes she has to feed me, but Mom is leaning against the kitchen doorway, smiling the nostalgia smile.
"I thought we'd wait for the bus together," Sadie says cheerfully, even though I know she doesn't typically ride the bus. "Two freezing ass backsides are better than one, I always say."
"Indeed," I say. Mom laughs in that muted way she has now of just breathing out her nose.
"It's good to see you again, Sadie. How are you?"
"I'm stellar, thanks," Sadie answers.
"What's going on with you?"
It's an awkward question these days, but better than, "How are you?" which we can never answer truthfully, and Sadie asks it in a completely casual tone. Mom doesn't lose the smile.
"Lex got into MIT, did she tell you?"
Sadie swings her gaze to me, blank face. "Massachusetts Institute of Technology," I explain, my cheeks heating. Mom puffs.
"It's the best mathematics program in the country."
Sadie gives a low whistle.
"Congrats, Lex. Wow."
I stare at my sneakers. "Thanks."
"She's going to do amazing things," Mom says.
Sadie nods.
"No doubt."
This is getting to be too much. "Come on." I grab my backpack in one hand and readjust my grip on the Pop-Tart with the other and lunge for the door. "We have to go if we don't want to miss the bus."
"You girls have a good day at school,"
Mom calls as Sadie follows me out, like we are 8 years old again.
"Your mom hasn't changed much," Sadie comments as we stand waiting.
It's funny, her saying that. My mom has changed so much since Sadie and I were best friends. I have changed so much. But every now and then, it's like we're allowed to act like our old selves. It comes back, if only for a moment. "I gave the letter to Ashley," I confess to Sadie when we're sitting in the front seat of the bus, the heater blowing loud and hot across our knees.
"Whoa," Sadie says. "What made you decide to finally do it? Last time I saw you..."
"I talked to her," I say, before she recounts her own rendition of the Ashley Kisses Grayson debacle. "She told me her side. Ty dumped her, not the other way around. Apparently he didn't even give her a reason, so I thought the letter might provide some explanation."
"You still didn't read it?"
I shake my head.
"God," Sadie says, "you and the iron self-control."
We don't talk for a while. Sadie plugs some earbuds into her phone, and I do the same with mine. Sadie's music choice? Rap, by the sound of it. Mine? Rachmaninoff. We cruise along through the endless white cornfields.
Then Sadie pulls one bud out and turns to me.
So Massachusetts, she says. That's a long way.
Yes, it is.
It's good news, though, right?
Right, but it's going to be hard, leaving my mom.
She's not going with you?
I frown at her, boggled by the idea.
You don't usually bring your parents to college with you, Sade. That would be weird.
Sadie gives me a half-smile.
I'll look after her, if you want.
What are you going to do after graduation?
She shrugs. Find a job?
You're not planning on college?
School's not really my thing.
She grimaces, like the idea of college is physically painful.
You're smart, though, Sadie,
I argue. She looks startled.
You are, I insist. You should go to college.
She sits back, surprised and pleased, and stares out the window for a while.
I'm not smart like you are,
she says. Well, I hold up my hands. Nobody's smart like I am, obviously. She grins.
Right. You're MIT material.
I'm MIT material, I agree. And it feels good that someone else knows. We go back to listening to our respective music for a while. Sadie's head bobs. I close my eyes and try to get lost in the piano concerto number 2. Sadie taps on my arm. I pull out my earbud.
You were brave, giving the letter to Ashley.
Her black-ringed blue eyes, so close to mine, are earnest, admiring.
That took guts.
It took forever before I actually did something about it, I say.
True, but you did something.
True.
And now Ty can move on,
she says, lowering her voice when she says his name so people don't hear.
He can be at peace now.
I don't know whether or not to believe her, but for once I hope she's right.
Yeah,
I say. Maybe now things will start to get back to normal. When we get to school, it's immediately apparent that something's wrong. It's too quiet. Students are standing in groups, whispering, the boys with their heads down, the girls looking tearful. Even the teachers are somber as they shuffle toward their classrooms. Something has happened. I don't like the way people are looking at me. There's a new awareness in their stares, which burns me before they turn away and go back to their hushed conversations. Something has happened that involves me in some way. My brain goes straight to the letter for Ashley. It must have had something to do with me, and she must be telling people about it. I knew I should have read the dumb letter. Why didn't I read the dumb letter? I spot Damien standing by the door to the counselor's office. He's crying. He sees me, and he starts crying harder. My heart is ice as I approach him. Hey, I rasp nervously. Are you okay? What's going on?
Patrick Murphy is dead,
he chokes out.
He was a sophomore. He was my friend. He was...
I know who Patrick Murphy is. One of the three amigos.
How?
I ask, but part of me already knows the answer.
He killed himself.
He wipes a fat tear that rolls down his chin and gives me a look that's pure despair.
At the train yard, about an hour ago.
My vision goes white. I lean against the wall and wait for the color to return. When it does, I'm so angry my hands are shaking. I know it's inappropriate and completely selfish, but at that moment, I'm furious at Patrick. Not for doing something so stupid as dying, not that, but for the way I know my mother's face is going to look when she hears the news. I'm mad at the way, just 5 minutes ago, I'd finally felt like I had the ground under my feet for the first time since Ty died. And now this. Damien goes back to crying, hard, like he doesn't care who's watching, his thin shoulders racked by sobs. I think, if I put my hand out and touch him on the shoulder, will it make it better or worse for him? I think, if I put my hand out and touch his shoulder, will I be able to hold it together myself? I think, no. I'm sorry, I murmur. I don't know if he hears me. Then I back away. There are so many people crying. I walk among them like a zombie. I think, I have to keep moving.
I have a big German test later. I have to keep my grades up for MIT. I have to pass with flying colors. I have to keep going. But the ground is flying out from under me. Something roars in my head. I hate everything in this moment. I hate the world. I hate life. Ty. Now Patrick. Another boy dead. 21. Somehow, I'm not even sure exactly how, I get through the rest of the day. I ride home. I make my way silently up the driveway and into my house. I take off my shoes and coat and set my backpack by the door. I pad down the hall into Mom's bedroom, through the room, into her bathroom. I open her bathroom cabinet and take down her bottle of prescription Valium. If this were Brave New World, I'd take the stupid Soma. I wonder if Mom knows yet. My heart squeezes at the thought. For a minute, I'm struck with a childlike desire to have her hold me and stroke my hair and tell me everything will be all right. I'm upset, and I want my mother to comfort me. That's what mothers do. But with this news about Patrick, I suspect it's going to be the other way around. She's going to need me. I need to keep it together. "We must learn to deal with the facts," I whisper. I look at the single bright pill in my hand for a minute, and then I put it in my mouth and lean over the faucet to swallow it down. I go to my room and curl up on my bed. 0 1 1 2 3 5 8 13 21 34 55 89 144 233 377 610 987 1597 2584 4181 6575 10987 46 17711 28368 75,025, 121,393, 196,418, 317,811, 514,229, 832,040, 1,346,269, 2,178,309, 3,524,578, 5,702,887, 9,227,465, 14,930,352, 24,157,817, 39,088,169. My head goes fuzzy. I imagine the Valium doing its work inside me, binding to the receptors in my brain. I can feel myself sliding, sliding off to the gray space, to sleep. I don't dream about anything at all. 11th of March. Here's my last real memory of Patrick Murphy, the day I caught Ty and his friends smoking in the playhouse. They were 12. Oh yeah, they were busted big time. Building stuff was one of Dad's temporary hobbies when I was about 9. It started when he decided to construct a custom doghouse for our dog, Sunny. He spent about 2 weeks on it in careful construction, nailing and sanding and laying real roof tiles on the top to keep the weather out. He even painted it to match our house, green with white trim. Sunny hated it. She much preferred the family room sofa. It didn't matter. Dad was so pleased with how the doghouse turned out that he decided to try his hand at something bigger, a playhouse. He went to Toys R Us to study the pictures of the $1,000 playhouses they sold and came home with a solemn promise to Ty and me that he would build us the best playhouse this side of the Mississippi, not some rough-shod, half-plastic monstrosity that would only look good for a summer or two, he said. Something solid. Something that would last. He enlisted the help of Aunt Jessica, who's an architect in Missouri.
She drew up the blueprint for a 500-square-foot, one-and-a-half-story playhouse, which was basically a square little room with a ladder and a loft. Dad bought the materials. He laid a set of pre-treated railroad ties as the foundation for the structure, in case we ever sold our house and wanted to move the playhouse, he said. He dug a 30-foot-long trench between the house and the far corner of the backyard so he could run electricity to our playhouse, so we could have lights. It was a big freaking deal. Dad built the frame first, then the roof. He put real insulation in the walls to keep it warm in the winter and cool in the summer. Ty and I wrote our names on the inside of one wall before Dad sealed it up with drywall and painted. He installed real glass windows that opened and closed, complete with screens to keep the bugs out, and a real, full-sized front door with a little window in it. Then he set down a layer of cheap, black-and-white checkered linoleum on the main floor and green carpet in the loft. The outside he painted to match our house, too, green with white trim, topped off with a tiny front porch with a porch light and everything. Mom sewed some curtains for the windows. She bought a large play kitchen set from a garage sale in Lincoln, a toy refrigerator, stove, and sink, with storage where I could keep my food Play-Doh molds, my plastic dishes and cups, and my tea set. She even splurged on a child-sized wooden table and chairs. Suddenly, all the neighborhood kids wanted to come to our house to play. Sadie and I practically lived in the playhouse from ages 9 to 12, our sleeping bags always ready to roll out in the loft. The green carpet became grass for our My Little Ponies and Barbie's front lawn, and the light blue walls were the sky, and we stuck glow-in-the-dark stars to the sloped ceiling. It was our own private world. I feel I must guiltily confess that it wasn't Ty's own private world, not until Sadie and I lost interest, which took a few years. Then, after dollies and Barbies and playing at being grown-ups lost their sparkle, the playhouse passed to Ty. So, that time with Patrick. Mom sent me out to the playhouse to bring Ty, Damien, and Patrick in for dinner. I knew there was something going down the minute I came through the door and heard all this scrambling up in the loft. I smelled the cigarettes right away. I mean, they hadn't even opened the windows. "Hey, you guys," I said cheerfully. "What are you doing?" I climbed halfway up the ladder and stuck my head into the loft. The boys all looked at me with wide, innocent eyes. "Nothing," Ty said. He gestured to Dad's old boombox, which was playing Stairway to Heaven. "We're just chillin'." I looked at Damien and Patrick. Damien looked the same as he does now, thin and bird-like, his clothes hanging off him in various shades of muted colors, gray eyes wary, like any second he expected somebody to attack him. Patrick was one of those kids who had orange hair like a sweet potato and white, white skin with freckles all over. His face was bright red. "Are you okay, Patrick?" I asked. He started coughing. The minute he opened his mouth, a puff of cigarette smoke came out. He coughed and coughed and coughed. I looked down for a minute. "Hmm," I said. Sigh. "Okay, boys, hand them over." Ty's face was a little green. He started to say, "Hand what over?" but I gave him a look that said he didn't want to mess with me. Ty brought his hands out from behind his back and produced their hastily stubbed-out cigarettes. They'd put them out on a piece of my porcelain tea set, the thoughtful little sweethearts. At least it's not pot, I thought. I stared at the plate, then rolled my eyes. "Where's the rest?"
"The rest?" squeaked Damien.
"The pack. Where is it?" They exchanged glances, and then decided there was no getting past me. Ty opened up the My Little Pony Dream Castle, where he'd stuffed the pack of Virginia Slims. I choked back a laugh. "Where did you get these?" Silence. "Tell me, or I tell the grown-ups."
"I swiped them from my mom's purse," Damien confessed.
I rubbed my eyes, sighed again. "You guys. Wow."
"Please don't tell," pleaded Patrick, almost in tears. "My dad would be so mad."
"You know why he would be mad?" I asked. "Because only morons smoke cigarettes." I looked at Damien. "Sorry, Damien, but your mom's a moron." He didn't argue. I held up the Virginia Slims pack. These kill you. It's slow, so you don't really notice, but they will kill you. They also make your breath smell bad, and turn your teeth yellow, and wreck your voice, and stain your fingers, and empty your wallet, and about 100 other terrible things.
We were trying it out once, Ty said. We weren't going to start smoking or anything. The girls at school think it's cool, Patrick said defensively.
Right, the girls in your middle school, whose center of the universe right now is the frickin' Rainbow Loom. I'll tell you what, I would never, ever kiss a guy who smoked. Ugh!
Not that I would ever kiss a guy, period, I thought wistfully. This was a few months before the infamous Nathan Thaddeus Dillinger II. Damien and Patrick looked thoughtful.
So are you going to tell Mom?
Ty asked. I thought about it for like 2 seconds. No, but only if you guys promise me you'll never do something this moronic again.
We promise, they said immediately.
I made them pinky swear. The most solemn oath.
Lexi? Mom called from the back porch. Boys!
I turned to the three amigos.
Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go straight into the house and say I told you to wash your disgusting boy hands, which you will do. Then we have to do something about your breath.
We could use Dad's mouthwash, Ty suggested.
Too obvious. I'll bring by a box of Tic Tacs while you're in there. You'll come out and have dinner, yum yum yum, and then Damien, you're going to go home and tell your mom you stole her cigarettes and give them back.
Damien's face went pale.
What?
You're going to tell her you stole her cigarettes because cigarettes kill people and you don't want her to die. She'll forgive you if you put it like that. Okay? Got it? Do we understand the plan?
Three nods. I marched them down the ladder and out of the playhouse.
You have, like, the best sister ever, I heard Patrick say to Ty as we crossed the yard. She's all right.
And that's the last thing I remember about Patrick, saying I was the best sister, wishing that he had a big sister like me.
22. Mom is making a green bean casserole. Her hands tremble slightly as she trims the beans with a sharp knife, but she doesn't cut herself. She scoops the beans up and delivers them into a pot of rapidly boiling water. She waits until they're tender, but still slightly crunchy. She drains them over a sieve in the kitchen sink. The steam fogs her glasses. Then she leaves them hot in the sink to open a can of cream of mushroom soup, which she whips together with a cup of milk, a quarter cup of French fried onions, a dash of salt, an eighth of a teaspoon of pepper, and a tablespoon of melted butter. She pours the frothy mix into a glass baking dish. She adds the green beans, stirs them gently, then covers the dish with foil. She puts the dish in the oven. She sets the timer. We wait. Outside, a single chickadee is perched on a branch near the kitchen window, chirping. Clouds are moving across the sky. Snow is falling in slow motion. The timer goes off. Mom dons a pair of mitts, reaches into the heat of the oven, and draws out the dish. She sets it on a hot pad on the counter and carefully rearranges another layer of French fried onions around the edges. I'm reminded of Christmas. Mom used to make green bean casserole at Christmas. She was never a top chef or anything, but it was a good casserole. I would watch her, just this way, as she put it together. This was the part where my hand would snake out and steal some onions. This was the part where, if she caught me, Mom would smack me on the wrist with her wooden spoon. Then she'd take a handful of onions for herself, and she'd smile, and I'd smile, and we'd eat them like it was some kind of marvelous secret between us. They were salty and left a layer of grease on my tongue, and I loved them. There was no green bean casserole this Christmas, for obvious reasons. We ate pity food for Christmas this year. Mom finishes dispensing the onions and returns the dish to the oven, uncovered this time. She resets the timer. We wait. The timer rings again. Mom gets the mitts and takes the casserole out. The onions on top have baked to a lovely golden brown. The air smells savory and rich. She puts the dish on the counter to cool. At the sink, Mom scrubs her hands in a way that reminds me of a surgeon prepping. She dries her hands and removes her apron to reveal her simple black sheath dress.
She smooths the fabric down her sides and pads off on bare feet with unpainted toes to retrieve her shoes, a pair of plain black pumps. She gracelessly leans against the table to slip them on, one foot at a time. Then she goes to the counter and measures out a new layer of foil for the casserole. She takes a black marker out of a drawer and writes, "From Joan and Alexis Riggs," across the top. She folds it over the casserole. She puts the dish into an insulated bag that will keep it warm. Then she picks up her purse and checks its contents. Lipstick, powder, a card for the Murphys, which she had me sign earlier. It says, "With sorrow for your loss." We have become the observers of tragedy. Mom checks her watch. She palms her car keys. Then she looks at me.
"Are you ready?"
she asks. I nod. She brushes off the shoulders of my black cable-knit sweater. "All right," she says, her voice as flat as if we were making a trip to the dentist. "Let's go." Patrick's funeral is held in the Cathedral of the Risen Christ, a different church than where we held Ty's funeral. Practically the entire school turns up, even the teachers and the principal and the office staff. Mom and I sit in the back of the sanctuary and try to ignore the way people are looking at us. Two ways, actually. A, they know that this funeral is going to be particularly hard for us, and they feel sorry for that, but they need to focus on the Murphys now, please understand. Which we do. And B, we shouldn't be here. Our kid infected this kid with the suicide disease. We should feel ashamed of this. Which we also kind of do. Maybe they're right. Maybe we shouldn't have come. But Mom wants to be here, if only to lend silent support, if only to prove to the Murphys that survival is possible. So we sit in the back. There's no viewing this time. Closed casket. Because it was death by train. Patrick's casket is white and shiny and edged with silver, like the hood of an expensive car. On top is a heap of red roses that I can smell from here. One rose by itself smells nice, but 24 of them fill the room with such a cloying sweetness that it overwhelms everything else. It makes my stomach turn. Still, there are worse things to smell than roses. At the foot of the casket, Patrick's dad stands next to a giant framed photograph of a younger, happier version of Patrick. His dad greets the people who line up to pay their respects, like some kind of twisted wedding reception in reverse. With the men, he shakes hands, but it's not so much a shaking motion as them grabbing his hand and holding it for a few seconds, then letting go. The women give him awkward, tearful hugs. I can't hear what they're saying, but I know that it's variants of "I'm sorry," and "Patrick was a good person," slash "kid," slash "student," slash "human being," slash "member of the swim team," and "call us if you need anything," and Patrick's father is saying "thank you," and "I know," and "I will," even though he probably won't. Patrick's mother died when he was a kid, car accident, so they've been through this before. He has a younger sister, but she's not standing with her dad. I locate her, already seated in the front pew. Her head is down, and I wonder if she's reading the program, or praying, or staring at her toes. I stared at my toes, when it was me sitting at the front of the church. The organist starts to play. People file into the pews and stand, singing. Mom hands me the program. On the front is a smaller black-and-white picture of Patrick, smiling his awkward smile, and a Bible verse, Romans chapter 8, verses 38 through 39. "For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Ty had the same scripture. It must be the go-to Bible passage for suicides. The song fades away. Patrick's dad joins the sister in the front row. The priest in his black robe climbs the steps to the podium. "Good afternoon," the priest says. "We are gathered here today to celebrate the life and mourn the passing of Patrick Michael Murphy." I don't remember much of Ty's funeral, What struck me about the funeral was that it ultimately felt like some kind of trial. Ty had committed a crime, premeditated murder, if you want to be technical, and we were all assembled there, his family and friends, his teachers and fellow students, as witnesses to testify to his good character. Everyone who got up to speak said an approximation of the same thing. Ty was kind. We never heard him say a cruel word to anyone. He worked hard in his classes, even if he wasn't the best student. He had some killer basketball moves, even if he wasn't very tall. He was a good dancer. He was sensitive. He felt things deeply. Maybe too deeply, the pastor said, as if that explained everything. Ty was good. Implication? He didn't deserve to be punished for his crime. He wasn't in his right mind. He wasn't thinking clearly. He didn't mean it. Please, God, please have mercy on his soul. To which God responded, "Neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Then everyone was allowed to feel better about it. When Mom got up to speak, she said she was grateful for the 16 years she got to spend with Ty. Wonderful years, she said. She thanked people. His piano teacher, his Boy Scout leader, his basketball coach, his favorite French teacher, etc., for making those years so wonderful. Her voice quavered, but she didn't cry. I was thinking that they had forgotten to mention that Ty was funny. I was remembering 2 years ago, around Christmas time, I teased him. I said Santa was going to bring him a stocking full of coal. I told him I hadn't decided yet if I was even going to get him a present. I didn't mean it, of course. He knew I didn't mean it. But then he said, and this I will never forget, "Well, I'm getting you a present." "You are?" "Yep," he said. "Just as soon as I can train the dog to poop into a box." He was funny. Mom was up there talking about how kind-hearted he was, and I was in the front row staring at my shoes, trying not to laugh at a joke he'd told 2 years ago, and trying not to cry at the fact that I would never hear him tell another joke. Dad didn't speak at Ty's funeral. He sat two rows behind us with Megan. He stayed out of the way. I didn't speak either. Mom asked me to, but I was afraid that if I got up in front of everybody, I would tell them about the promise I had made to Ty— that I would be there for him when he needed me, when he called. The promise I had broken. Then it would have been me on trial. Maybe I deserved that, but I couldn't face it. At the end of Ty's funeral, they played Elvis's version of "Take My Hand, Precious Lord," my mother's favorite church song. Ty would have freaked. Elvis at his funeral. But it didn't matter. Ty was dead. Mom was alive. In so many ways, the peach roses, the deep mahogany casket that matched our dining room table, the music, the scriptures, the food. She'd planned his funeral to be her own. 23. After Patrick's funeral, we drive to Wayuka Cemetery for the graveside part. It's sleeting, a miserable combination of rain and slush, and we stand under black umbrellas around the grave. His father and sister cry brokenheartedly when the men lower the coffin into the ground. Mom cries, too. I don't. I didn't then, either. I was all cried out by the time we got to the cemetery. The priest says a few final words, and then we move like a herd of sheep into a room inside the funeral home for the wake. Mom brings along the green bean casserole to be heated and served. It's not as good as I remember. They set up two poster-sized collages against the far wall. I slip away from Mom to look at them. It's not like Ty's collage, which was in a fancy frame. Patrick's collages are two pieces of poster board, the kind you can buy at the supermarket, the pictures stuck on with tape. Patrick had a lot of friends, like Ty. He was on the swim team. He was an athlete, like Ty. He was an Eagle Scout. Ty never made it that far, but still a Boy Scout like Ty. He played video games. He was a good kid, like Ty.
This is the worst kind of déjà vu. In the second collage, I find a picture I recognize, a copy of the same photo Ty used in his collage. Patrick from middle school with Ty and Damien, the three amigos, arms around one another because they hadn't learned yet it's not cool for boys to hug. First Patrick, then Ty, then Damien. Damien looks the same, I think, wearing his gray hoodie and pale denim jeans, lanky and uncombed. He holds his left hand up with his two fingers making a peace sign. The three of them smile mischievously into the camera like they know something I don't. I swallow. I know something they don't, too. Then the sound system over my head starts playing Stairway to Heaven. I freeze. I look around and spot the funeral director, Jane, I remember, standing in a corner. "Hey, Jane," I say as I approach her. "Why are you playing the song?" "Hello, Alexis." She remembers me, too. Patrick left a note requesting, among other things, a specific playlist to be played at the wake. I close my eyes as Robert Plant starts singing, "There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven." "Alexis," Jane murmurs, "are you all right?" I open my eyes. "What about the collages?" "What about them?" "Did someone make them, or did he?" She gives me another somber smile. "He made them." "He made them, just like Ty. He planned all of this, just like Ty. Like he was using Ty's death as a template for his own. Ty helped this happen, by showing Patrick that it was some kind of acceptable, maybe even cool, thing to do. He led by example. This is Ty's fault. All of a sudden, it becomes too much. I have to get out of here. I search for Mom. It takes me a while to locate her, and when I find her, I hold back, even though what I want to do is charge up to her and grab her by the hand and drag her out of here. But she's sitting in a folding chair next to Patrick's dad, looking into her lap as she talks. I can't hear what she's saying, but Patrick's dad is nodding, nodding, tears slipping down his face. She could be a while. The song is building in intensity, the way it does, and as it builds, I feel less and less in control of myself. The hole is opening in my chest. The room is closing in. I stumble back and knock a chair over. It clatters loudly to the floor. I see Damien, not wearing his gray hoodie, but a black button-down dress shirt. He combed his hair. His eyes are red. He steps forward like he wants to say something to me, like he wants to hug me. I take another step back. I see Ashley Davenport standing by the collage. She's holding hands with Grayson, and they're both staring at me. Everybody's staring. I have to get out. I have to get out. I have to get out. I fight the urge to push people out of my way. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. A hand comes down on my shoulder. Beaker. She meets my eyes and sees the panic, and her jaw sets determinedly. She whirls around.
"Hey, give us some room here," she says in a loud voice. "Let us by, please. Excuse me."
She weaves me through the crowd. Then we're outside. I sit down on the curb near the hearse and try to catch my breath. Beaker stands over me like she's keeping guard. I've never been so glad to see Beaker. I could almost cry, I'm so glad.
"Are you okay?"
she asks.
"Not really." "Do you want something to drink? I think there's lemonade in there. It's the foul, powdered stuff, but it's cold and it's liquid."
"No, thanks." She drops down beside me and leans back, stretching her legs out in front of her. She's wearing a gray wool skirt and stripy socks. Only Beaker would wear striped socks to a funeral.
"Well," she says after a minute, "that was like the worst thing ever. I've missed Beaker."
"Where is Elle?" I ask.
"Elle doesn't do funerals."
"She was at Ty's," I point out. Beaker looks at me gravely.
"Yes, she went to Ty's. I thought I was going to have to get her a paper bag to breathe into. She almost lost it like 10 times. Something about how she threw up at her great-aunt's funeral when she was 7.
"Oh." I feel dumb that I didn't know any of that. I wasn't paying attention to my friends at Ty's funeral. Apparently, I assumed the world revolved around me and my pain. If I'd known that, I wouldn't have asked her to...
She would have come anyway.
Beaker yanks a blade of old brown grass out of the lawn and twists it around her finger.
She's your friend. She loves